Hélène. Should Aigu Plateau, Cantal, France, March 1st, 1944. Hubert and I sit up in bed, hands folded behind our heads, ankles crossed, discussing the various ways in which I might kill Gaspar. Perhaps I should snap his neck. I yawn again, lamenting the long night and inadequate sleep. From this angle, I can see only the tops of the tallest trees out of the window. They are all dark and bare against the newly woken sky.
You could shoot him, Hubert offers.
Too much blood spatter. He turns his head on the pillow and gives me a withering look.
Don't tell me you get queasy at the sight of blood.
I am a devoted fan of the male species. They are brave, brilliant, offer endless entertainment, are good for moving heavy objects, and make the act of procreation a great deal more enjoyable. I'd hate to see a world in which they did not exist. But sometimes they can be spectacular idiots. Insinuate such a thing again, and I will smother you with a jam rag. The room grows brighter every moment, and I stare at Hubert long enough to watch the colour bloom in his cheeks and then spread to his temples like a rash.
You don't have to be vulgar, he says finally.
And you don't have to be stupid. Show me a girl who gets wobbly at the sight of blood, and I'll show you someone who hasn't hit puberty. Dealing with blood is one of the most basic realities for every woman alive. The man I am to call Hubert for the foreseeable future is married to a lovely yet banal woman. I doubt they have ever discussed the physical realities of what it means to be female or what she must put up with for that 1 week every month. I've known Hubert for 6 months now and he still has no idea what to do with me. He does the only logical thing and changes the subject.
You probably shouldn't kill Gaspar, he says.
Why not? This is the most interesting thing that's happened since we left London. I've never killed a man and I'm itching to try. He seems like a good place to start. The corner of Hubert's mouth twitches and I know that we've made our peace.
He's our contact.
He's a dog with two dicks. Hubert says nothing, so I try to explain.
That means I know what it means.
He clears his throat and I take the win. This is the closest I have ever come to making Hubert laugh, and I am feeling victorious until he says,
You don't have to do that with me, you know.
What?
Curse.
I didn't take you for the easily offended type.
I'm not. Spent years in the military, remember?
So why the lecture?
You use profanity as a weapon, a way to be disarming, to charm or sometimes offend, depending on your audience. It's how you demand parity and respect with your male co-workers.
But you already have my respect. You did from our first day of training.
I just wanted you to know that before Gaspar makes an appearance.
His face is perfectly expressionless, and if not for his slow blink and the gentle rise and fall of his chest, I might suspect he was dead.
You respect me?
Immensely.
But you do not like me.
He grins.
Not in the slightest.
I am looking at Hubert, intrigued, when a stomping and rattling begins downstairs. The clatter of pans, chairs scraping across old wood floors, the whoosh of air going up the flue as someone lights a fire. Laughter and grumbling and the groan of rusty pipes as a man pulls the chain in the loo downstairs.
Sounds like Gaspar is up and about, Hubert says.
How long before he puts his little plan into action?
Depends.
On?
What he finds when he comes in here.
You don't think he'll wait for us to make an appearance downstairs? I ask. Despite our current situation, Hubert would not be my first choice as bedfellow. He is starched and humourless, possessed of excellent insight into human character, but without imagination otherwise. Yet Buckmaster paired us together for a number of very specific reasons. Some of them are still a mystery to me, but one in particular became evident early on in our acquaintance. I am not hard of hearing by any stretch, but Hubert has bat-like abilities in that area. The answer to my question comes a breath later,
when I hear someone stomping up the stairs. I pride myself on being a woman who gives credit where credit is due, so I say, "Well done. But how do you know it's him and not Judex?" "Whoever is coming up those stairs is a good bit heavier than any of the men we met last night." I listen as the footfalls grow closer. He's right. In delicate clumps belonging to someone who is secure enough in his position to not mind giving away the sign of his approach. "Besides," Hubert adds, "Judex hasn't left the landing all night. The third step from the top squeaks every time he moves." The benefits of having a bat for a partner are becoming more and more evident by the second. I make a mental note never to argue with Morris Buckmaster again. I did not earn my place with the SOE by being unintelligent. Both of my service revolvers are cocked and ready beneath the bedspread. I slide my left hand under the quilt and wrap my palm around the grip. And that's another of the reasons why Buckmaster paired me with Hubert. I'm a better left-hand shot than he is. Hubert, for his part, is holding both of his revolvers behind his pillow. He might look relaxed, but one twitch of an elbow and our looming guest will find himself with a perfectly round hole in the middle of his forehead, with another to match in his breastbone 2 seconds later. "Think he'll knock first?" I ask. "Unlikely." And once again, Hubert is correct. The door is kicked open so abruptly that it shudders on its hinges, sending a fine film of dust onto the floor. I assume that Gaspar expected to find us in flagrante delicto, given his look of surprise when he sees that we are on the bed, fully clothed, and unperturbed by his arrival. "What is this?" he demands. He is a big, barrel-chested brute of a man. Olive skin, small black eyes, a great heap of stiff dark hair that sits atop his head like a bottle brush, a beard that hasn't been trimmed in months. If he were a dog, one would think he had the mange. "As if we could sleep. You and your men sound like a herd of buffalo down there," I say. He glares at me. "Oh, buffalo, right. It's an animal native to the United States. Big, lumbering, terribly ugly, smells like old shit left in the sun to bake." Gaspar, for all his faults, and there are many, rallies quickly. "Bison," he says, "is another word for that animal." I tip my head to the side. Interesting. "But," he continues, waving a hand at us, "what is this? You two, in bed, dressed." His expression changes more quickly than I would have thought possible. It goes from bewilderment to obscenity in a heartbeat. I brush the index finger of my left hand against the barrel of my service revolver. "What did you expect?"
"My men said you were pretty."
"So you assumed I am a prostitute? That I prefer sex to sleep?"
"No."
I can see the tightening of Gaspar's eyes as he recalibrates the situation. Decision made, he turns his attention to Hubert.
"But I see the problem now. Your friend is not much of a man."
The thing I love most about Brits is that they are not easily perturbed. Certainly not by pompous Frenchmen. Hubert looks at Gaspar as he would a bit of dung stuck to the bottom of his shoe.
"We are here to assist with your efforts against the Germans," Hubert says, "not cavort in the bed linens."
Gaspar gives me a pointed look.
"What are bed linens for if not cavorting?"
"Sleeping," I say. He takes a step across the threshold.
"Perhaps you just need a different sort of man."
"Alors, tu veux coucher avec moi?"
Clearly the man is not accustomed to seducing a woman before an audience, but I am forcing his hand, so the effect is painfully awkward. Just as I intended. I can feel Hubert vibrating with suppressed laughter beside me.
"What man would not want to sleep with you, madame?"
Gaspar says, clumsily, answering my question. I have been looked over by worse than the likes of him, and I don't so much as break eye contact as he peruses what little he can see above the quilt. I tip my head toward Hubert.
"That one, for starters." "Then he is a fool."
The one in front of me isn't much better.
Meaning? That I do not think much of what I see.
Gaspar is unrelenting. He moves a hand to his belt buckle.
Then perhaps you would like to see a bit more?
No doubt even your best effort would be unsatisfactory. Besides, I have no desire to be murdered in my sleep and then have my money stolen.
I wait a moment as Gaspar's face pales. I would have expected a better plan from a man with your reputation.
How could you suggest such a thing?
I heard it with my own ears.
Impossible.
Insinuating that I am a whore is one thing, but calling me a liar is something else entirely.
I flip back the quilt, allowing Gaspar to see the revolver held in my left hand. Hubert follows my lead, bringing each of his guns out from behind the pillow. We stare at Gaspar until he drops his eyes.
This is war. I am not ashamed of being strategic, he says with a shrug.
I would not fault you for strategy, but I cannot forgive stupidity.
There is not a single thing about Gaspar that I like. He is cursed with hubris and disdain for others. But he does think quickly on his feet.
You mentioned money, he says. How much? Enough to arm my men?
The Eighth Commandment forbids me to lie. I learned this in Sunday school, had it drilled into me by Miss Maggie Monroe. But I believe that even she would take no issue with me as I tell Gaspar that I have only enough cash on my person to buy lunch, and a poor one at that. I do not feel guilt for the outright fabrication, nor do I give it a second thought. Gaspar considers Hubert and me, now standing, service revolvers at the ready.
What a disappointment, he mutters.
Of all that he has said, this bothers me most. I have been called any number of things by men in my 31 years, but disappointing has never been one of them.
You have no money,
he spits, literally spits onto the floor.
And you have no radio operator. You are of no use to me. Taudiva will answer for bringing you here.
Gaspar would choke on his own teeth if he knew the amount of cash hidden in my purse, but I would sooner swallow the whole lump dry than give him a single franc. Hubert taps the barrel of his revolver against his thigh.
You will not accept our help, and we find you abhorrent. What now?
Gaspar shrugs.
You are no longer my problem.
I really wish you had let me kill Gaspar, I tell Hubert, as we sit on a low rock wall surrounding a small cemetery 10 kilometers from the chateau.
Waste of a bullet.
Oh, I don't know. I think dispatching Gaspar would have been a great boon to the war effort. Might have even earned us a medal, unlike our current enterprise.
I wave an arm at the country lane that stretches in either direction.
For all the good we're doing, they may as well have parachuted us into Brighton.
It's only been 12 hours. I snort.
Slow start.
We left Gaspar's encampment on foot several hours earlier. Threatening to kill us was somewhat expected. Trying to send us off with an empty belly was unconscionable, so we made him endure an awkward breakfast in which we ate more than our fair share of porridge with raisins. It was almost entirely tasteless, but it did stick to our ribs, and we haven't been hungry since.
Hubert chose this inauspicious resting place to assess our situation because the lane runs straight for a good distance in either direction of the cemetery. We're not likely to be ambushed by Gaspar's men or anyone else in this location. The lane is covered here by a broad canopy of bare branches, and little pools of light filter through, making the ground look like a patchwork quilt that has been pieced together badly. It is as pleasant as a cemetery can be, I suppose.
How far to Shod Egu? I ask.
Hubert examines the Michelin map he keeps folded in a tiny square and tucked into his boot. After a moment of turning the map this way and that, then finding his bearings based on the sun's position, he points south, down the lane.
Roughly 50 kilometers.
Small mercies. We can make it before dinner, weather and road permitting, of course.
although we'll have to go through introductions again with this Fournier, and I'm looking forward to that about as much as shaving my legs with a cheese grater.
Women. Hubert doesn't say the word aloud, but I can see him shaking his head in consternation.
Well, let him try to shave his legs a single time, much less every 2 days for the rest of his life, and see how he feels about the process. Or the analogy.
Our orders were to rendezvous with Gaspar because his group is the largest in the area. We could have never known in London that it is also the most arrogant, over-concentrated, unintelligent, and ill-prepared group of men in the entirety of France. I don't like having to shift to an alternate plan any more than Hubert does, but there are other groups, all of whom need assistance as well. And having been rejected by Gaspar, we move on to the next name on our list. A list that is stored well within the folds of my own grey matter. Hubert might have exceptional hearing, but I have fabulous recall. Names, dates, facts, locations. I can remember all of it with uncanny skill. However, I have only 2 details regarding our next contact. His name is Henri Fournier, and his group is based near the town of Chaudes-Aigues.
What do you think is wrong with the French? I ask.
A great deal, Hubert says, but you must be more specific.
Not a single one of them can seem to name their sons anything but Henri. Here an Henri, there an Henri, everywhere an Henri, Henri, I say in a sing-song voice. I'll have to call our new contact Fournier. It's too confusing otherwise.
I don't care what you call him, we just need to get there.
Hubert drags himself off the stone wall and begins to stretch, but no sooner does he have his arms over his head than he freezes. He looks as though he's surrendering to an enemy force. Very slowly, Hubert turns his head to the south and stares down the lane.
What?
A car is coming. I squint down the road but cannot see a thing other than dirt and shadows.
A German patrol car?
Probably. He gives me a single nod and then vaults over the low stone wall and squats down behind it. We have a bit of time, so I ready myself. I drop my purse and backpack behind the wall next to Hubert, set both revolvers in my lap and cover them with my coat, sit up a bit straighter, put on my pretty face, as my husband calls it, cross my legs, and wait. Before long, a little Renault sputters into view, weaving this way and that to avoid potholes. It's headed toward us at an urgent clip, and a cloud of dust blows up in its wake. I know the driver has seen me when the car begins to slow. And then it's screeching to a stop, spitting bits of gravel against the wall beside me. The driver rolls down his window and sticks his head out.
"Choosing a suitable grave, are you, ducky?"
he says, in the most perfect aristocratic English.
"Good God, I hate you, you shameless piece of shit!"
I jump up from the wall and wave my revolvers in delight. Dennis Rake, our radio operator, has finally decided to make an appearance. Rake unfolds his long, limber body from the car, looking every bit the ballet dancer.
"I would have it no other way, ducky. What an odious world it would be if you actually liked me."
The nickname he's given me stems from our first meeting in England, and Rake has never once called me by my given name. He looks at my raised weapons without the slightest bit of concern.
"It's not as though I deserted. There's no need to gather a firing squad."
I set down the revolvers and launch myself into his arms, giving him a hug and then a sloppy kiss on each cheek. There are no words to describe my delight at seeing him, so I don't attempt to find any.
"About time you got here," Hubert says, as he scrambles to his feet from behind the wall.
"Ah, there you are, letting our girl do the work as usual."
I gather my stuff and begin loading it into the back seat of the car.
"Where have you been? We thought you were dead."
"My dear, swarms of Germans were chasing me everywhere. It's a miracle I got away."
A cock and bull story if I ever heard one. Rake has a lover somewhere in the country, and everyone knows he flew in a few days early for a rendezvous.
"Hogwash," Hubert mumbles under his breath.
"The real question," Rake says,
is why the bloody hell the two of you are out here in the middle of nowhere. Tardivar told me to meet you at Gaspar's compound at Montmouchet.
I let Rake know what happened with Gaspar as quickly as I can, along with my feelings toward the man and where we're headed now. He shakes his head and turns to Hubert.
You should have let her kill him.
Hubert tosses his bag into the back seat beside mine, then climbs in next to it.
I'm sure she'll get her chance. I have a suspicion Gaspar isn't going anywhere.
Chaude Aigu Plateau, Cantal, France. Château de Couffour. I decide immediately that I like Fournier. He and a number of his men have taken up residence in the Château de Couffour, a home so old it makes Gaspar's residence look like new construction. It is situated outside Chaude Aigu, a large town in the mountainous Cantal region that sits at the bottom of a winding river valley and is surrounded by imposing hills and plateaus for 50 kilometers in every direction. At any other time, the region would be considered scenic, the sort of place you'd spend a long holiday at the peak of summer. As it stands, under German occupation, it is difficult to traverse and remote enough to keep the enemy at bay. Crisscrossed by deep rivers, heavy with snowmelt, and not easily accessible by any major roadway, it is the perfect location from which to wage guerrilla warfare. Perfect for hiding from enemy forces, and most important to us, clandestine airdrops from London. These maquisards are not formal soldiers. They are citizens, average men driven into the wilderness to escape either the Germans or the Relève, the forced conscription of French nationals into the German workforce. They have left their homes and their families to make one last desperate stand against Hitler's invaders. I respect them, and I want to help them. Like Gaspar, Fournier has considerable forces, but unlike him, they are not concentrated in the immediate vicinity. He has broken his men into groups of 50 and 100 and settled them throughout the Chaude Aigu Plateau. In the forest mostly, but also in small towns and villages along every roadway in order to keep an eye on German troop movements. Fournier is no idiot, however. For himself, he has chosen the remote, comfortable Château de Couffour, a 15th century castle somewhat restored to its former glory. Of the seven original towers, only one remains, but it is 3 stories tall, is in excellent condition, and has a pointed conical roof and a spiral staircase. There are 11 other rooms in the chateau, one of which happens to be an expansive and fully stocked wine cellar. He tells Hubert all this within moments of our arrival, and I get the impression that he is trying to convince us to stay. It's not a hard sell. It's brilliant, I say, giving Fournier my nod of approval. Then I stick out my hand. You and your men may call me Madame André. He glances from me to Hubert, then back to me, then to Dennis, and I see the confusion register on his face. Once again, he turns to my tall, confident partner, a man so obviously military that he must be in charge. André is the chef du parachutage, Hubert says. Talk to her. Fournier's eyes snap back to mine, but they are narrowed slightly. Pardon, he says. I did not mean to offend. We are glad to have you, and your associates. Hubert and Denden introduce themselves, giving the code names they've been assigned for our interactions with the Maquis. Fournier is the exact opposite of Gaspar. Short and bald, diminutive in stature and voice, there isn't a blustery bone in his body. His eyes are wide, curious, and clear as well water. Fournier listens to us without interrupting. Your arrival could not be more timely. I have run out of money. Have you been working with another agent? Hubert asks. Victor or Patrice, perhaps? I do not know these men, Fournier says. I spent my own money to arm my men. Everything I made in 30 years of business. It's gone, he adds with a shrug. But I do not regret it.
It is one thing for me to hand out freshly printed francs, courtesy of the British government, but this man has spent every cent he's earned fighting the Germans. His is exactly the kind of group we have come to help. Tell us what you need, I say. Fournier wastes no time in making a list. The group of 50 men situated in and around the chateau has only the most rudimentary arms and little to no ammunition. They need money. They need boots, socks, food. They need everything. But there is a system in place, and I must abide by it. I will not distribute so much as a firework until I've assessed his group for myself. I believe we can help, I tell Fournier. But first, we would like to meet your men. Once our tour is complete, we convene back at the Renault. As ever, Hubert's face is unreadable, but I know his mind is racing. Our starting point has been established, but it is daunting. I turn to Rake. All your equipment is in working order? He nods. Yes. Good. Let's see if we can get through to London tonight and let them know we've made contact with the Marquis. We'll test out that radio of yours by requesting a shipment of arms for Fournier. God bless Dennis Rake. He pulls his radio equipment out of the car and marches it right into the chateau. Hubert and I gather our bags and choose separate rooms in the tower. I don't have time for a much-needed bath, so I just wash my face, apply a bit of perfume, and brush my hair. A quick nap, no more than 30 minutes, and a bit of lipstick, and I'm right as rain again. Hubert and I meet Rake and Fournier in the study an hour later. It's nearing dusk, and Rake is bent over the table inspecting a little notebook littered with markings I can't read. What is that? Shorthand? In what language? Hungarian. You speak Hungarian? Hubert asks. Bit of a long story, that, Rake says, running a thick finger over the squiggly lines. Okay then, rain check. What are you looking for? I ask. The time of tonight's transmission. He taps the page, finding what he's looking for, then stuffs the notebook back into his boot. I am expected to come through to London at a different time on each day of the month. This is my first time radioing in, see, and I want to make sure I've got it right. He looks at the clock. It is March 1st. They'll be listening for our transmission at 8:15. Rake, Hubert, and I are all startled at the sharp sound of Fournier's clap. Excellent, he says. We can eat dinner first. It's not quite as easy as that, I say. We have to determine our drop zones, name them, and transmit the coordinates before we can request a shipment. It's already growing late, and I have to code the messages before Denden can send them. Once again, Fournier proves himself to be my favourite kind of Frenchman. He shrugs. It's dinner for two in the study, then? Three. Hubert drops into a chair beside the large ornate desk where Rake has situated his radio and props up his feet. In the end, Fournier cannot curb his enthusiasm and decides to join us, bringing in two large platters of simple but freshly cooked food, roasted rutabagas, turnips, and Jerusalem artichokes, sprinkled with a bit of salt, along with a loaf of rustic bread and, much to our delight, a bottle of wine. Most people boil their roots, he says, setting the platter, four plates, and our forks on the table. But I think roasting brings out the flavour. It's better with onions and garlic. But you can't find such things in this part of the country until later in the spring, and then only wild ones in the forest. We make do. We mumble our gratitude as we tuck into dinner, and after a few minutes, Fournier tactfully clears his throat. I do not mean to interfere, but I have a suggestion about where you might want to place your drop zones. Hubert lifts his head to meet Fournier's gaze. You know the area, you need the supplies. It's not interference. By all means, tell us. Let me get my map, Fournier says. No need. He spreads his map out on the table beside our plates. Fournier studies the map, turning it around several times before setting the tip of his index finger on our location. "We are here," he says, then scoots his finger over an inch. "And this is the closest plateau. It is elevated, flat, visible from the air, and perfectly clear of trees, brush, and debris." Hubert considers for a moment, then his eyes tighten. "Yes, but it is cut off on three sides by the River Truyère. We could find ourselves trapped between rapids and plateau in the event of a German ambush." Fournier nods solemnly. "That would be a very real concern, had I not already instructed my men to identify and prepare routes of escape at several points along the river." If Hubert is frugal with his words, then he is positively stingy with his smiles. But the corner of his lips does curl up at this news, and he gives Fournier the nod, his very specific show of respect. Rake and I work into the evening, nibbling on our dinner as we go. It is provincial, but not without flavour, and the wine helps tremendously. We consult Hubert's map, identifying all the possible drop zones within a 10-kilometer radius. We name each of them after fruit, strawberry, lemon, apple, orange, etc., then record and code their exact map references. After a bit of trial and error, we finally have our list. We watch as the little wall clock turns to 8:15, and Dennis begins tapping out his first message in Morse code. "Turn on the radio," he says, after what seems like an eternity. "The BBC French service." Fournier fumbles with the dials, and we listen in silence to the scratchy sounds of classical music broadcast over the airwaves. "I let London know we have made contact, and I transmitted the coordinates for our drop zones." "How will we know they received them?" Fournier asks. "Just wait," Rake says. Our dinner is gone and our plates shoved aside, when finally at 9 o'clock the music fades out and an announcer comes on. "And now for some personal messages," he says. What follows this announcement is the most seemingly random litany of nonsense we have ever heard. Song lyrics, nursery rhymes, a biblical genealogy, car parts, 3 entries from a dictionary, and then the phrase we have been waiting for. "A cricket chirps in Kent." "We've gotten through," Rake shouts, and I swear to God I think I actually see Hubert smile. Fournier looks like he might stand on the table and dance. Now that contact has been confirmed, I hand our first message to Dennis Rake, and he turns back to his transmitter. He begins to methodically tap out our request in Morse code. "Hélène to London. Contact made with Group Leader 2. Wants boots, Sten guns, ammunition, grenades, and cash for 50 men at Lemon. The cow jumped over the moon." It was Buckmaster's idea to use fruit. He thought it would be easier for me to name the drop zones after vegetation than vehicles, which was Hubert's preference. The bit of nursery rhyme was my idea, just to irritate Buckmaster, and is known only to Rake and myself as a security measure. Regardless, London now knows that we are here, what Fournier's group needs, and that the message is in fact coming from me. Once more we turn our attention to the radio, and half an hour later we hear the announcer say, in the most deadpan voice possible, "A frog is croaking in the mountains." Now we can be sure that in the English countryside, in a manor house stuffed with radio operators working on rotating shifts around the clock, our transmission has been recorded. And then a call has been made to Buckmaster's London office. Our request has been received and approved. "They can call me a frog or a witch or a stinging nettle for all I care. Help is on the way." "Okay then," Rake says, laying his headset on the table. "With any luck, we'll have our first shipment tomorrow night." I don't realize how exhausted I am until I drop into the narrow bed in my room. Sleep rushes toward me in a heavy wave, and my last waking thought is that of Henri, and the fact that I am now, finally, back in the same country as my husband. London comes through in spectacular fashion the next night. We wait atop the plateau, henceforth known as Lemon, once the sun has gone down. It is well after midnight when we hear the great lumbering engines of a Liberator bomber. "Think it's that same crew we had on the way in?" I ask Hubert. "Possibly," he says, eyes trained on the dark western sky, and I imagine he hears 15 different things that are lost to me. Fournier and his 50 men wait along the tree line as Hubert, Dennis, and I stand beside the bonfire. A single fire is all I've allowed. I'll be damned if I'll have festival lights greeting our pilots. The ones I had on landing were more than enough. And as I pointed out to Fournier, though the plateau is the perfect drop zone, it is also visible for miles around. No need to draw unwanted attention. Before long, the Liberator is in sight, a great black hulk against the lesser darkness of the sky. It's all rattle and clank and bombastic noise as it makes its first pass over the airfield. Fournier's men cheer, and then they curse, thinking the plane has missed us. But it circles back a moment later, and then the first silver parachute deploys. Six more follow, and below each of them dangles a massive wooden crate. The crates are on the ground in seconds. They are swarmed by Fournier's men, who've been given strict instructions to only open the boxes but not remove anything. I have to inventory the weapons first. Then we must clean and degrease everything before they can be distributed. I learn on this first night what a laborious process that is. The weapons are packed in cosmoline, a sticky, greasy goo that is impervious to heat, cold, and moisture. However, the weapons won't work properly until the wretched substance has been removed from stock to stem. Our eyes are heavy and our fingers numb when Hubert hears the trucks. A quick conference with Fournier confirms that he is not expecting anyone else to meet us here. We are surrounded by weapons, but half of them are still packed in grease, and not a single one is loaded. It's like dying of thirst in the middle of the ocean. Water, water everywhere, and not a drop to drink. I reach for my service revolver, only to remember that I took it out of my holster an hour ago and set it atop my pack because it was hard to squat beside the crate with it strapped to my thigh. Stupid woman. My pack is, of course, sitting there wide open on the other side of the bonfire. Hubert, I say, looking to my pack and then to him. I only brought the one. I dive for my pack as five trucks crest the plateau, blinding us with their headlights. All around me, I can sense Fournier's men slip into the shadows and disappear. Most of them aren't armed. That's why we're here, after all. And those who are have little in the way of ammunition. They wait and they watch. One by one, the engines cut off, but the headlights remain on. My pack is only 3 feet away and my revolver sits in plain sight, but reaching for it now could get both Hubert and me killed. The creak of a car door, a thump as it slams shut. Then an enormous man steps into the broad yellow beam of the headlights. His face is hidden in darkness, but I can see that he is wearing tall brown boots, a brown shirt, and a German military cap. He holds a pistol in one hand, and a whip hangs from his belt. Nancy Grace Augusta Wake. Le Train Bleu, northbound toward Paris, 1936. I wake to gentle rocking and cool air on my face. Stephanie sits beside the open window, blowing smoke from her gitane into the fresh air of the French countryside. The blue velvet curtains are pushed against the wall behind her head, and little strands of hair cling to the fabric like gilded cobwebs. Picon sits on her lap, licking pastry flakes from her dressing gown. When he sees that I'm awake, he hops down, skips across the plush carpet, and leaps into my berth. Picon wags his tail ferociously and pulls himself into a tiny ball beneath my chin. Stephanie and I didn't speak last night when we left Le Bar de la Marine, or when we returned to our hotel. Assuming that I was drunk on lust, she left me to my thoughts. And when I left the hotel 15 minutes later, she no doubt thought I was off to rendezvous with Henri. Needless to say, she was stunned when I returned a short time later with 2 train tickets and a determined expression. "Pack your things," I said. "We're going back to Paris."
"Tonight?"
"Right now."
"You cannot be serious. We're booked on the first train tomorrow. Don't you want to sleep?"
"The blue train leaves the station in less than an hour, and I'll be on it with or without you." She ceased arguing at this. I knew that the only way I could convince Stephanie to leave Marseille 12 hours early was to book a private compartment on the Calais Méditerranée Express, Paris's infamous and elegant express night train, Le Train Bleu, as it is called for its lavish blue sleeping cars. The price of admission was enough to make me flinch, but it got me hard and fast away from Henri Fiocca. Money well spent as far as I'm concerned. The man makes me nervous. He's too handsome, too confident, too persistent. So we boarded the train just after midnight and went to sleep in our separate berths, surrounded by cobalt velvet and gold trim. Stephanie glares at me now, but I know she can't be too angry. She's always wanted to ride the blue train and has taken full advantage of the experience by having breakfast brought to our car. A tray littered with hot coffee, croissant, ripe berries, fresh cream, polished silver, and pressed linen napkins sits on a stand in the middle of the floor. Now that Picon is no longer there to clean them up, she brushes a crumb from her lap and says,
"Please tell me you did not give Henri Fiocca your phone number."
I stretch out until the tips of my toes and the palms of my hands are pressed against the walls at each end of my berth. I hold my breath and let my sore muscles burn with the strain. "Of course not."
"Good. At least you've learned something from me."
"I'm not such a poor student as that, you know." Stephanie takes a long drag and turns her chin toward the window. The smoke slips away in a thin silver stream as she stares at me from between slitted eyelids.
"Did you not find him attractive?"
"He is a ridiculously virile male specimen. I look away." She makes one of those nondescript noises that French women are famous for and picks a piece of tobacco from her tongue with perfectly filed nails.
"Not rich enough?"
"I don't care about his money."
"Liar."
"Oh, stop," I say. "If you don't know me better than that, our friendship isn't worth much."
"His money isn't important to you at all?"
I consider this and tell her the absolute truth. The fact that Henri Fiocca has money is more pleasantly unimportant than if he had none.
"It's not just that he has money, Nancy. He's, how do the Brits say it? Bloody loaded."
Her imitation of a British accent is more Liverpool than Knightsbridge, but I applaud the effort with a bit of clapping as I try to hide my smile. But after a minute, I sit up and point a finger at her. "And that is why I left. I refused to be like that blonde he was with last night, falling out of my dress and desperate for his attention, for his money." I shrug, finally getting around to what I really mean. "He thinks I'm a sure thing." I can't tell whether she's impressed or frustrated by my resistance.
"What happened on the dance floor? It looked as though the two of you hit it off in spectacular fashion. I've never seen you dance so well."
"He's a tall, handsome Frenchman who knows the tango. What do you think happened?"
"Ah."
She looks at me with pity.
"You fell in love. I did warn you about that."
"No," I object. "You challenged me. But I know better than to expect anything but play from a playboy. I will not become a notch on his bedpost." She grins slyly.
"So you will run instead? Have I not convinced you that he's a worthwhile conquest?"
"It is Fiocca's job to convince me, not yours." Paris, Rue Sainte-Anne, 2nd arrondissement.
I can't believe it worked.
Frank Gilmore slides the New York Evening Journal back across my kitchen table.
"Milo submitted your article."
He taps the date.
"This was published 2 days after we met with him."
"It didn't work at all, actually," I say.
"What do you mean?"
I tap the space where a byline should be. It's blank. Where's your name? Frank demands.
Where indeed?
Poor Frank. He has never considered the possibility of not getting credit for a job well done.
I don't understand.
It's not that complicated, really, I say. I'm a woman.
So?
So, Hearst does not publish the names of its female journalists, particularly its freelancers. That's just how it is, I was told at the beginning when they hired me.
But that's
bullshit, yes, I know. Milo likely didn't even file my name with the article.
He's an arsemonger, Frank spits. This is your victory. You should be able to take it.
I should have negotiated this byline. I should have demanded it. But the truth is, I didn't even think Milo would concede and file it at all. Besides, this is the first time in the 3 years that I've been writing for Hearst that I have seen one of my articles in print. Of course, this would be the one on the front page above the fold. I submit them, and I know they're published because I get paid, but they are always printed in the United States, in cities with strange-sounding names like Houston and San Francisco and Detroit. Until a courier delivered this paper an hour ago, it has always felt like a job I have in theory, but not in reality. Milo wired the editor of the New York Evening Journal and asked him to send a copy as proof that he'd done my bidding. I am told the editor sent this copy with a friend who was traveling to Paris from Lakehurst, New Jersey, by way of Frankfurt and the Hindenburg.
Quicker than the mail, Milo said in his accompanying note.
Without your name, it doesn't count, Frank argues, growing more incensed by the moment.
You are being erased from history even as you're writing it.
I had an option early on of choosing a male pen name, I tell him.
Why didn't you?
I decided that if I couldn't get credit for my work as myself, I wasn't willing to give it to a man who doesn't even exist. Besides, I needed the paycheck desperately. And when I signed on, it was either take their terms or go back to Australia. Frank opens his mouth, and I know where he's going, so I stick my finger right in his face.
Don't you dare say, but what about George Eliot? Don't you dare! Marianne Evans made her choice, and so did I.
All the while, Stephanie has been listening to our conversation without comment. She's positioned herself at the seat closest to the window, so she can blow her cigarette smoke out onto Rue Sainte-Anne instead of my tiny 400-square-foot flat. I smoke when the mood strikes me, usually when I'm angry, but Stephanie smokes a lot. Perhaps too much. She'd be furious with me if she knew how I'm starting to worry. But she's not looking at me right now, or wondering what I'm thinking. She taps her ash into one of the empty pots in the wrought iron flower box fixed beneath the window. I planted geraniums in them last summer, but they've long since shriveled with neglect. I meant to replace them this year with something a little more low maintenance like ivy, but never got around to it. Stephanie doesn't seem to notice, however, but rather pours another finger of brandy into each of our glasses. We've been drinking for an hour, and I've got that pleasant, tingly feeling in my head. Like I could dance or nap. One or the other. A coin toss, really. Present company prevents me from doing either, however.
Nancy doesn't actually enjoy journalism, Stephanie says. And can you blame her?
I guess not. Frank looks at me as though I've just been accused of not enjoying chocolate or sex. But the whole thing is a damned pity. You're so good at it.
I hate being pitied, so I change the subject. I don't dislike journalism. It's the travel I love. What other job lets you jaunt off anywhere in the world on someone else's dime? If I have to write an article now and again in exchange, even if I don't get credit, so be it.
Frank looks as though he might argue with my logic, but thinks better of it. I suspect that, even though he's far fonder of his camera than I am of my typewriter, his motives are similar. We've both been to a dozen countries and counting. Besides, it's not my skill as a wordsmith that makes me an excellent journalist. It's my curiosity.
How did you get into this, then? He asks.
I was living in London at the time, I say, lifting my glass from the table and swirling the amber-coloured brandy until a tiny whirl forms at the bottom of the glass. I watch, mesmerised, until the liquid settles. Stephanie brought a bottle of Remy Martin from Count Gonzalez's private collection to celebrate the occasion, and it has been on the window ledge just long enough to taste like black cherries set in the sun to ripen. I roll it around my tongue before finishing the thought. Warm and sweet and rich. Aged vanilla with cloves, but woodsy as well, with a hint of cedar and orange peel. It's like bourbon, only better somehow, as though bourbon got dressed up and went out for drinks. I absolutely loved it, of course, I say, until winter arrived. The boat I'd taken from New York docked early that fall, and I spent those first days watching the changing of the guard at Buckingham Palace, buying frivolous trinkets up and down Piccadilly, lying about beneath the trees in Hyde Park, and marking the time according to the chimes of Big Ben. London sounds romantic, and it is mostly, until it turns grey and soggy in late November. I'd left sunny Australia and gone through New York that summer, so I wasn't prepared for London winters. But I was quickly running out of money, and I knew that I had to get a job or go home. Home was not an option, I wanted to keep travelling. So I checked out of my hotel and acquired a room at a charmingly disreputable boarding house on Cromwell Road and enrolled at Queen's College for Journalism. They had a course I was able to finish in a few months, mostly typing and shorthand, and the second I had my diploma, I started answering advertisements for freelance journalists in the newspapers. The first call I received was from an editor at the London Bureau of the Hearst Newspaper Group, and thanks to my newly acquired diploma, they wanted to see me. Frank has that look on his face, like he can't decide whether to shake his head, laugh, or call my bluff. The editor liked the marks I'd gotten in typing and shorthand, I continue, but he was more interested in Egypt than anything else. Egypt? Stephanie asks. What did that have to do with anything? He wanted to know if I'd ever been, and how much I knew about the country in general. The Middle East was a growing area of interest for Hearst, and they were looking for a writer who could enlighten their readers in the areas of Egyptian arts, literature, and science. Frank nods with sympathy. The poor bloke just gets nicer the more he drinks. So, you were buggered? Not in the least. I told that man without so much as a blink that not only had I been to Cairo 4 times, but that I could read and write in Egyptian, fluently. Stephanie laughs so hard I fear she might choke on her brandy, and Frank looks at me agog. You did not, he says. I most certainly did. Didn't he ask for proof? Of course. And I gave it to him. Both of them are perched on the edge of their seats, and I think that even though I don't particularly enjoy the process of writing, I do love the art of storytelling. He asked for a demonstration, and when I agreed, he handed me a pen and notepad, pulled a book from his shelf, flipped it open, and began reading a random passage. And what did you do? Stephanie asks. I started to write in delicate squiggles, swirls, and curls across the page, backward from right to left. He was awestruck as I continued my hieroglyphics for a full page. And when he finished, I read the passage back to him verbatim. This is where I lose Frank. Bullshit, he says. Excuse me? He throws up his hands. Bullshit. I'm not a complete knob, you know. Modern Egyptian writing is in Arabic, not hieroglyphics. So? So there's no way you could have fooled him. Can you read Arabic, Frank? Or hieroglyphics? His eyes narrow and he hesitates. No. Well, neither could he. So, when I read the notes I'd written in Pitman shorthand back to him without error, he was convinced. I wait until they've both finished laughing before I add, had that particular test been graded, I no doubt would have gotten excellent marks for resourcefulness. But terrible marks for honesty, Frank adds. Stephanie waves off the observation. Honestly, Nancy, you're so good at this kind of thing, you should have been a criminal. If I hadn't gotten the job, I would have seriously considered it. But as it turned out, he offered one on the spot, with a single stipulation. Which was? Frank asks. That I move to Paris, the Hearst European Bureau was understaffed.
Brilliant,
he shouts, raising his glass in salute. It is worth noting that I met our dear Stephanie only a week after my arrival. I was having a drink at Luigi's, admiring my new city from the terrace, when a row started at the other end of the bar. The crowd parted just in time for me to see Stephanie throw a pitcher of water at her husband's head while cursing simultaneously in French and Yugoslavian.
The Count deserved it, she says without apology.
He left, Stephanie stayed, and I thought it would be interesting to befriend a woman who could so easily clear a room. There is a great deal more to that particular story, of course, but Stephanie has long since sworn me to silence. I am considering whether to accept the next round of offered brandy, when the phone rings. I feel more than a little lightheaded, so I decline a refill and bring my empty glass with me as I cross the room and lift the receiver from the box on my wall. This is Nancy. My voice isn't slurred, but I can hear my thrumming Aussie accent more than usual.
Bonjour, Nancy.
Well, this is interesting. Henri Fiocca has finally called. I'm not the kind of girl to wait by the phone, but it has been a week. I was beginning to wonder if he'd lost interest. Mr. Fiocca, I say, voice lowered so my friends cannot hear me. I am suddenly self-conscious about sharing this conversation.
I thought we established that I would like you to call me Henri.
You requesting a thing does not mean it's established. You should already know me better than that.
I have been trying to know you better, but you keep resisting.
I laugh, and for good reason, too.
Hold on a moment, I say, placing a hand over the receiver. I look at Stephanie and Frank.
This is important. Not that I want Fiocca to know that, of course. I look at them pointedly until they take the hint and begin collecting their things. I move my hand and say quietly,
Would you mind calling back in 15 minutes? I'm in the middle of something.
Yes, of course.
Excellent.
I hang up. Frank isn't quite stumbling drunk when I kick them out of my flat. More of a gentle sway, like a palm tree. Stephanie, as usual, is stone-cold sober. She winks at me, mouths the word Fiocca, then wiggles her fingers in farewell, flashing a triumphant grin as I close the door in her face. She had twice as much to drink as either of us, and she isn't the slightest bit pickled. I am determined to learn her methods, if for no other reason than an innate desire to be the last man standing, because I am tottering quite badly. I lean my forehead against the door, listening to the sound of their retreating footsteps. Then I exhale when all is silent once more. So much for running from Henri Fiocca. He's caught up to me rather quickly. What on earth am I going to do about that man? Absolutely nothing, I say out loud as I make my way to the kitchen for a big glass of water. He's not some problem to be solved. He's... I look at Picon for an answer, but he's curled up on the rug, fast asleep in a patch of sunlight. Hell if I know what Henri Fiocca is exactly. Dead sexy. Intriguing. Wildly impressed with himself. Tall, strong, yet gentle in the way that only big men can be. And his voice, it is an aphrodisiac. Which is a strange realization, to be honest, because I always thought I was susceptible to a Scottish accent. And yet here I am, falling for a Frenchman.
Ugh, I will not. It's ridiculous. I don't have time for this.
Which does nothing to explain why I'm brushing my hair until it crackles and applying another coat of lipstick, as though he's about to walk through the door at any moment. 15 minutes later, on the dot, my phone rings again. Hello, this is Nancy, I say again, knowing full well who is on the other end.
Nancy?
I take a slow breath through my nose and press my shoulder to the wall. I curl the phone cord around one finger.
I suppose you got my number from Stephanie?
He chuckles.
Of course.
Hmm, remind me to thank her. There is an odd pause on the other end, and for a moment I think that he's nervous, that he doesn't know what to say next.
Fjoka clears his throat and asks, "Why did you leave Marseille? I came to Le Bar de la Marine the next night, ready to dance, but you were not there."
"That's when I was scheduled to leave. I have a job, you know, and a life."
"You didn't mention leaving that night. Why?"
"I could lie. That's what I typically do when put in these situations. But something about Henri Fjoka makes me want to discard the typical and run headlong at the truth."
"You seem to think I'm a sure thing," I say, "like some blonde who tags along after you."
"I was quite clear about my preference for brunettes."
"Yes, well, it's their preference for you that I find alarming. I'm not interested in competing for your attention."
"Let me assure you," he says, voice dropping lower, "you have my full attention. There is no competition."
I'm sure he says that to all his girls, but the fact that we are on the phone and not face to face has me feeling bold.
"Prove it," I say.
"Have dinner with me tonight and I will."
"No."
"But," he clears his throat, "you said if I called you would dine with me. A promise is a promise."
Something occurs to me a few beats too late.
"You're in Paris?"
"Oui, on business."
He does not fall for the change of subject.
"Dinner?"
The news of his proximity has thrown me.
"I will not dine with you tonight."
A pause to gather my thoughts, and then, "I'm meeting a few colleagues at Luigi's. We have a lot to catch up on."
"Dinner tomorrow, then?"
There's no way out of it now.
"Yes."
"When may I collect you?"
There is an art to setting a time for such a date. Early in the evening tells a man that you have no intention of going to bed with him. Late in the evening declares yourself open to other intentions. There is only one reasonable option in a situation like this.
8 o'clock,
I say. Neither early nor late.
I can hear the smile in his voice as he recognizes what I've done. This is a game. Winner take all.
"And your address?"
I give it to him.
"Tomorrow then, Nancy."
He hangs up first this time, and I stand there for a moment, the receiver pressed against my ear, lips pursed, unable to determine whether I am excited or terrified.
Paris. Ristorante Luigi, 8 Rue de Bussy. I wear my favorite armor to Luigi's, red lipstick. The fact that I'm also wearing a swishy dress and shiny black pumps doesn't hurt, nor does the carefully curled hair or the heavy swipe of mascara. It's something I've already come to think of as the Fjoka effect, this desire to be noticed. The dress itself isn't anything special, just a light blue cotton with a scoop neck, neatly belted, but it's enough to get Frank Gilmore's attention. He notices me leaning across the bar, giving instructions to Enzo, the barman. Frank waves me over to the raucous, crowded table in the corner, but I hold up one finger. Wait.
"Don't forget," I tell Enzo. He responds with a nod and there's a mischievous twinkle in his eyes, as if he'd like to say about damn time, but he's a smart man and he keeps his mouth shut. Contingency plan in place, I make my way to the back of the room. A collective roar of "Nancy!" goes up, and I survey the table crowded with my fellow freelancers, journalists and photographers, every one of them male.
"I was just telling them about your job interview, Nance," Frank says, pulling out a chair for me.
He's sobered up nicely since this afternoon. Probably went home and passed out for several hours.
"Those damn hieroglyphics of yours."
"Well, don't let me interrupt you." I pull Picon out of my purse and listen as Frank continues. I scratch Picon's fuzzy chin and he licks my pinky finger. A few minutes later, Frank gives me a questioning glance.
"What kind of shorthand was it?"
"Pittman,"
Pitman shorthand, he finishes. She'd written the entire thing backward in shorthand.
My colleagues laugh and cheer, and I watch as Frank positions himself for his grand finale.
And it's just that kind of ingenuity, no, brilliance, that earned our girl the lead article on the front page of the New York Evening Journal.
And with that, he pulls the newspaper from inside his suit coat and brandishes it with a flourish. It does not escape my attention that his thumb is covering the place where my name should be. I'd been in such a rush to evict him earlier that I hadn't even noticed the paper was gone, hadn't given it a second thought since speaking with Fjoka. Frank Gilmore, kind man that he is trying to give me the credit Hearst would not. I'm not sure how it is elsewhere in the world, or even elsewhere in Paris, but our little group of freelancers is unusually supportive. Sure, we're all out there scrambling for our stories, following our leads, and keeping them to ourselves when necessary, but once the story is printed, we celebrate one another. And as is customary, the winner buys the first round of drinks. I'm the only girl in this motley group of seven, and the only one who prefers brandy to beer. I wait until Frank summons the waiter, and we put in our orders, before I tell a story of my own. Did anyone bother to ask Frank why the article was printed without a photograph? They all look at him and the colour seeps across Frank's great big potato head. It's a wonder the strain doesn't turn him ginger on the spot. It's because his camera was smashed to bits in Vienna by one of those bastard brown shirts. I saw it with my own eyes. Our friends look at him closer now, nodding, respectful. That is a battle scar to be proud of. And this is how it goes among the journos. We tell stories, mostly about politics and politicians and all the surrounding wars, skirmishes, assassinations, elections. But sometimes, we tell stories on and about ourselves as well. We regale one another with tales of our humiliations and humanity. Frank did me the honor of showing the others that I am clever, so I return the favor by making sure they know he is brave. I pause as our waiter deposits our drinks on the table, and only when he's gone do I finish my story. Frank didn't even flinch when that arschloch yanked the camera from his hand, smashed it onto the cobblestones, and kicked the pieces into the fire. He should have been right there with me on the front page. I raise my glass, wink at him, then repeat his words from earlier that day. It's a damned pity he wasn't. To Frank. To Frank! They respond, tipping their glasses toward him in salute. It's only after all the glasses have been clinked and he's been slapped hard enough on the back to rattle his teeth that a second, and now very familiar, drink is set on the table beside my brandy. A French 75. I knew it. I absolutely knew it. Then comes the whisper, low and filled with humour, in my ear.
I take this to mean that you were expecting me?
My breath catches in my throat, and I hold it for 3 long seconds. I knew you wouldn't be able to stay away.
Is that so?
My smile is victorious. You are nothing if not predictable, Fjoka.
You did ask me to prove it, ma chère.
I knew as soon as I mentioned my meeting at Luigi's to Henri on the phone earlier that he would send the drink. If pressed, I might even admit that I'd done it on purpose. Maybe I don't want to wait until tomorrow to see him. Maybe. And since I'm being honest, especially given how little time I've actually spent with the man, I rather suspected he'd show up in person to place the order. So I told Enzo not to let him off the hook when he arrived. As a matter of fact, I ordered Enzo to send Henri over with the drink himself. It's why I wore this blue dress. Frank has noticed Henri's presence, and his eyes narrow. It's amazing how quickly my attention has shifted from my colleagues to my... I'm not entirely sure what to call him. But as he sets his hand casually on my shoulder, I am aware that Henri is something more to me than any other man at this table.
Who's your friend, Nancy? Frank asks.
This is Henri Fjoka. Frank glances at Henri, and then at the hand that rests on my shoulder, thumb lightly brushing the side of my neck. Intimate. Possessive.
"And what are your intentions with our dear Nancy?" he asks Henri.
It's a bold, defiant question, and I love Frank all the more for it. He won't be brushed off quite that easily. I turn my head to look up at Henri. I'd like to know the answer to that as well. His voice and his face are perfectly calm when he says,
"I have travelled all the way from Marseille, over 6 hours by train, to deflower her."
But then he dips his chin and winks at me.
"Well, if that's your goal, you'll need to go in search of a different garden," I say. "That bloom has long since been plucked."
My poor friends are scandalized to hear such talk, Frank more than any of them. But Henri throws his head back and roars with laughter. His shoulders shake, and he presses his free hand to his chest as though he can't quite find enough oxygen to replenish his empty lungs. And that, right there, is what turns the tide in his favour. I won't go as far as to say that he's proven anything to me, but I am willing to let him try.
I pull a handful of francs from my billfold and hand them to Frank. "That should be enough to cover drinks," I say. Then I stand, sling my purse over one shoulder, tuck Picon under my arm, and swallow the last of my brandy in a long pull that leaves my throat burning. Fiocca's eyes widen, but he says nothing as I lift the French 75 from the table. "Good night, boys," I tell my friends. They all stare at me, but no one protests. I've done stranger things, and honestly, their chances of picking up female companions are greater if I'm not present. I can see that Frank understands, though, and he surrenders. He gives me a single nod, I blow him a kiss, and then I'm out the door with Henri Fiocca. We're already halfway down the street before it occurs to me that I've just stolen a cocktail glass from Luigi's. Oh well, I'll bring it back tomorrow, along with a tip for Enzo. Fiocca is nearly a head taller than everyone around us, and I am very glad that I've worn my tallest heels. Still, I have to peer up at him, and I'm unsure what to say. So I take a sip of my French 75 instead. This makes him smile.
"Easy there. You're crossing streams."
"What?"
"First the brandy, now gin and champagne. You'll be asleep on a park bench by 7 o'clock at this rate."
"So that's the trick. I did wonder how you Frenchies hold your liquor so well."
"It's just one of the tricks. I'll teach you the others one day."
Fiocca lifts his hand and I think he might touch me, perhaps brush my cheek or tuck a bit of hair behind my ear. But he scratches Picon behind the ears instead.
"And who is this?"
I say with all seriousness, "The great love of my life."
"Ah, a rival. What is his name?"
"Picon."
"And how do you do, sir?" Henri says,
offering his knuckles for a sniff. Picon obliges and then licks them twice. Henri bows his head slightly in gratitude.
"A pleasure to meet you as well."
And what am I supposed to do with that? I mean, really, how could anyone not fall for such a man?
Henri returns his fingers to the soft dip between Picon's ears and continues his ministrations. My poor little dog nearly goes limp from pleasure. His tongue lolls, his hind legs twitch. After a moment, Henri says,
"Perhaps the gentleman won't mind a bit of friendly competition?"
He could be persuaded to share, under the right circumstances.
"Care to detail what those might be?"
"I'm afraid you'll just have to discover them for yourself."
"Well, you have made it quite clear that you are not interested in having dinner this evening, but perhaps you will walk with me instead? The Seine at dusk is, I believe, the 8th wonder of the world."
"Is that so?"
"Perhaps the 9th. He winks.
A walk sounds lovely, but I am wearing uncomfortable shoes.
"Then we will walk slowly."
Without waiting for an answer, Henri plucks Picon out of my arms and sets him gently on his shoulder, splayed out like a bear rug, one set of legs down his back and the other down his chest. He holds my little dog there with one hand, giving him a reassuring scratch, and then offers me his other arm. I am delighted by this unexpected, gentle act, so I slide my hand into the crook of his elbow, and Henri steers us toward the river while I sip my drink.
I do not think it is legal to walk and drink at the same time. Surely there is some law about this, he says.
Then you will have to bail me out of jail, Mr. Fjorka, because I have every intention of finishing this delightful cocktail.
I don't plan to surrender you to the Sûreté. They will have to pry you from my arms.
Is that where you expect me to be?
A man can hope.
Luigi's is only a few blocks from the Seine, and once we are through the early crowds headed toward dinner, the river walk opens up before us like a golden cobblestone ribbon. Henri hears my quick intake of breath and pulls my hand tight against his side. I have lived in this city for 3 years. How have I never walked the river at sunset?
There is much to see in Paris, ma chère. It takes a lifetime to fully appreciate everything it has to offer.
The sky is a deep, cloudless blue, broken only by the startling golden pink of a sinking sun. But I am equally stunned by the term of endearment he's just used. It's the second time tonight. It's a bit early to be calling me dear, don't you think?
He shrugs. I am French, and you are beautiful. It makes sense to me.
I was not at Luigi's long enough to order dinner, so I begin to feel quite warm and happy as I take another sip of my French 75. Henri glances at me sideways as I hold the near-empty glass up to the last light of the sun and watch the colours refract across my fingers.
I am glad you like it, he says.
I am hungry and happy and slightly buzzed, so I tell him the truth. No one has ever called me dear before, not even my parents. I do like it. Henri lowers his head until his lips brush across my cheekbone, and he whispers in my ear,
I meant the drink, but I am glad to see that you appreciate my efforts to prove my affection as well.
I cannot remember the last time I well and truly blushed. My face matches the sky. He brushes the knuckles of his free hand against my cheek.
A girl who blushes. Now that is a pretty sight. I look at him for a long time, but don't respond. What are you thinking?
I am thinking, I say, that I am actually quite hungry after all.
Me too.
And then Henri Fjorka kisses me right there on the river walk. It's not that I haven't been kissed before. I am 24 years old and I am not innocent. But still, I have never been kissed like this. It is thunder and rose petals at once, static electricity and delicate intimacy. His lips are warm and soft and sweet. He goes slow at first, and then he's hungry, ravenous in fact. Henri Fjorka is consuming me, tasting me. I think if his hands were free, he might lift me off the ground altogether. I imagine us falling into the river. I imagine us falling in love, getting married, having babies, growing old. I imagine silk sheets and ripe strawberries, sweat, swearing, begging. It lasts 10 seconds, but it may as well be a lifetime for all that I've planned out. I am Mrs. Damned Fjorka by the time he pulls away. Henri looks at me as though I have single-handedly invented womankind, as though I am Eve herself. He looks at me as if I am sun, moon, and stars all rolled into one, a galaxy. I am terrified of how I might be looking at him, as though all my thoughts are written right there on my face.
Shall we find somewhere to eat? He says.
I consider it a great testament to my character that I do not suggest him as the main course.
Henri, would you like to come in? Nancy asks. It is well past midnight, and they stand at the door of her tiny flat. His laughing girl is quite solidly drunk. She is bright and funny and has a wit sharp enough to scratch diamonds, but the poor girl cannot hold her liquor. It goes straight to her head in the most charming and unnerving way. At the very least, she's had too much for one day. At worst, it is Henri's fault, and he has allowed her to go too far around the bend. He takes full responsibility for the fact that she is leaning against him, warm and soft, inviting him not just into her home, but, he suspects, her bed as well. So he tells her the truth. Yes, I would very much like to come in. He's not entirely sure what she had to drink before he arrived at Luigi's, at least the one glass of brandy, but she has since had a French 75 during their walk and another while they waited for a table. Then they shared a bottle of Chenin Blanc during dinner at Le Fouquet's. He does the math. At least one glass of liquor, two cocktails, and two glasses of champagne over a five-hour period. That would be enough to make an experienced drinker feel fuzzy around the edges. Henri had only the champagne and a few sips of her 75, so he isn't addled at all. He has, however, learned any number of things about Nancy this evening, each more fascinating than the last. She is the youngest of six children. She left home at 16. She has traveled much of the world alone. She loves brandy, but hates beer. She carries her little dog in her purse, but would sooner shave her head than own a cat. She cannot sing, whistle, or clap in time to music. She cannot ride a bicycle. She hates goat cheese. You should have seen the way she pushed it to the edge of the charcuterie tray with her fork and then wiped the tines on her napkin. But we'll eat a pound of feta in one sitting. He did his best to make her laugh throughout dinner just so he could hear the sound. He introduced her to gratinade scallops poached in white wine and served over mushroom puree on the half shell. They talked, and they ate, and they drank. Far too much, he realizes now. Nancy fumbles with her key, trying to fit it in the lock. "Let me," he says, gently pulling it from her hand after her third attempt. Henri turns it easily and helps her into the flat. She sets her purse on the floor so Piquant can climb out, and then she kicks off her shoes. Nancy sways to some music in her head as she takes his hand and leads him toward the bedroom. It's only a few steps from the front door to her room, and it's a good thing, too, because she won't stay upright much longer. Her bedroom is small, but the bed is large, and it's piled high with blankets and extra pillows. Nancy turns on the lamp, and Henri turns down the bed. Her eyes are heavy, and her smile is soft, and she isn't startled in the least when he scoops her up and sets her on the mattress. Then he pulls the covers up and tucks them beneath her chin. Only then do her eyes register a hint of surprise.
You aren't coming to bed with me?
No.
Why not?
You're drunk, ma fille qui rit.
So are you.
He laughs. I've never been that drunk.
Henri.
Her eyes, heavier now, open once more, but with a struggle.
What does it mean?
What?
Ma fille.
He bends low over the bed and brushes his lips against the soft curl of her ear. My laughing girl. Her voice is barely a whisper.
Is that what you think I am?
Filled with laughter? Oui.
No,
she clarifies.
Yours.
Indeed I do. A second kiss, this time on her temple. Clever girl. I see that you've caught on. And then she has slipped beneath the folds of sleep, her breath a gentle wisp of air between parted lips. "Good night, Nancy," he says. Henri stands there a bit longer than is polite, watching her sleep, and is jolted from his trance only when he feels something nudge his ankle. Little Picon stands beside him, tail wagging. "Have I won you over then, good sir? It's your mistress I'm more interested in, but I'll consider it a win if I've earned your trust." Thanks to their walk earlier that evening, his suit coat is covered in fine white dog hairs, so he slides out of it and arranges it near Nancy's feet. Then he plucks Picon from the floor and settles him in the center of the small nest. Picon yawns, little pink tongue curling at the end like a soup spoon, and burrows deeper inside. Henri sets her keys on the nightstand, turns off the lamp, and makes his way to the kitchen. It takes him several minutes, but he finds a pen in one of the drawers, and offering a prayer for forgiveness, scribbles the number to his hotel onto the wall beside her phone. "Good night, Nancy," he whispers again into the darkness, and then he walks out of her flat, locking the door behind him.